Welcome to today's episode of A Slice of Medieval. We have a real treat today. A good friend of mine, Nathan Amy, is joining us to talk about the House of Beaufort. Nathan is an author from Carmarthenshire, although he was living in York when I first met him, and has now moved down to London. He focuses on the 15th century and the reign of Henry VII. His first book on Tudor Wales came out in 2014, and in 2017, his full-length biography, which I think is actually the standard for the Beaufort family, The House of Beaufort, was a number one Amazon bestseller. His next book, Henry VII and the Tudor Pretenders, Simnel, Warbeck and Warwick, was also a bestseller. He is one half of a very successful duo with Matthew Lewis, arguing the various points of the Wars of the Roses, and has a gorgeous cat called Vera. Welcome, Nathan.
Thank you very much, Sharon. Thank you. Thank you, Derek, for inviting me on to discuss the Beauforts. Always fun to go back to what was my first proper book and have a chat. So looking forward to it.
Thank you. So am I. I mean, me and you, we've spoken about the Beauforts before. And I studied Joan Beaufort myself. And when I was reading your book, I think I fell a little in love with Thomas Beaufort, who was probably the best of the three boys. But why don't you start by telling us a little bit, for those who haven't yet read the book, who were the Beauforts?
Well, the Beauforts were the illegitimate children of John of Gaunt and Catherine Swynford. John of Gaunt was probably one of the most powerful men in Europe during his day, you know, the mid to late 14th century, supremely wealthy, incredibly ambitious, as well as being the Duke of Lancaster, which he actually attained through his first marriage to an heiress named Blanche of Lancaster. As well as being Duke of Lancaster, John of Gaunt was Earl of Lancaster, Earl of Leicester, Earl of Lincoln, Earl of Derby. You know, there was no one more powerful or richer than John of Gaunt outside the king during this day. But he did seem to have a bit of a naughty side, shall we say, and he embarked on an affair with one of his governesses in his ducal nursery, and that was Lady Catherine Swynford. Lady Catherine was married to one of John of Gaunt's retainers, a chap called Hugh Swynford from Lincoln. And this extramarital affair, it did yield four children born out of wedlock during the 1470s. Now, these children, you know, they had no entitlement to their father's title as a surname, and they had no entitlement to their mother's married name of Swynford. So when they were born, they couldn't have been called John Lancaster or John Swynford, for example. So John of Gaunt, their father, what he decides to do is he decides to give them a name inspired by one of his former French possessions, and that is the Castle of Beaufort. So he names his children, these four illegitimate children, John Beaufort, Henry Beaufort, Thomas Beaufort, and Joan Beaufort. Three boys, one daughter. But people knew who they were. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a reference in one of the chronicles, I think it's Adam of Usk, where the eldest of this illegitimate brood is called John Beaufort of Lancaster. So they're definitely associated very closely with the House of Lancaster throughout their childhood. You know, they are given a very good upbringing and they are always looked after and acknowledged by their father, John of Gaunt. I mean, we could probably do a whole podcast all day just on John of Gaunt himself. But what's interesting is in 1396, 25 years after the birth of the first Beaufort child, John of Gaunt, due to widowhood, is free to marry again. And at this point, Catherine Swynford has long been not just a widow herself, but also a long-acknowledged mistress of John of Gaunt. And what he decides to do is quite remarkable for the age. He marries Catherine Swynford. Now, it's unheard of for a prince, a Plantagenet prince, to marry his common born mistress. And that's exactly what he does in 1396. We're told by one chronicler, Thomas Walsingham, that this occurred much to the astonishment of people in England and France because she was of humble birth. And another chronicler claims that this had occurred to the amazement of all, for she had a very small fortune. Bit harsh on Catherine Swinford on both accounts. John of Gaunt had no need of money, of course. I would suggest this marriage is probably as close as we're going to get to being able to confirm some semblance of a love match. Mm. John of Gaunt always retains his affection for Catherine Swinford, but this stage in his life, he doesn't need to marry anyone for any money, any power. You know, they're both in middle age. There's no requirement for this marriage. And he chooses to marry her. And it does scandalize everybody. But it does allow John of Gaunt to set in motion plans to retrospectively legitimize his Beaufort illegitimate offspring. And that is, of course, something that would have, well, far-reaching consequences, really.
So why did he do that then? Given the fact that he must have known that he would have had consequences, why did he do it?
Well, I mean, around this point in time that we're talking about, so 1396, 1397, he only has one legitimate male heir, and that is Henry Bolingbroke. Now, any students of this period will know straight away that Henry Bolingbroke was on the outs with the King Richard II, his cousin. You know, he was on very shaky ground, having constantly taken stands against the king. We do know that within a year or two, Henry Bolingbroke would actually be banished from England. Mm. You know, Richard II's had enough of his cousin and he banishes him from the kingdom. When John of Gaunt dies in 1399, 3 years later, this banishment is turned into an exile for life. Henry Bolingbroke has lost everything. The House of Lancaster, in effect, comes to an end with his banishment. John of Gaunt may have known and may have anticipated this. He may have known the character of his nephew, Richard II, who was, you know, a bit of an idiot. You know, Richard II is one of those famous tyrants in history who seemed to try and do as much as he could to destabilize his own crown and his own kingdom. So John of Gaunt may have anticipated all of this. I believe there's a possibility he's tried to bring his Beaufort offspring into the legal, legitimate royal family so that it's an assurance policy. He has an alternative Lancastrian line of succession, you know, not necessarily for the crown, of course, but just for his ducal lands, you know, his possessions, his earldoms, and also to try and galvanize another group, another crew around his legitimate son, Henry Bolingbroke. You know, the Beauforts and Henry Bolingbroke had always grown up very close. They were always acknowledged half-siblings. They were raised in close proximity. They knew each other well. So I think it was some sort of insurance policy, really, to bolster the House of Lancaster during a time they were really under attack from Richard II.
Now, this is the controversial one, and I know you have an idea about this. The argument against Henry VII becoming king in 1485 is that the Beauforts were barred from the throne by Henry IV. Were they really?
This is going to be quite a complex answer. But so first and foremost, Henry VII. Let's look at that really quickly. Henry VII was allegedly barred from the throne because of an earlier stipulation put into the Beauforts' Act of Legitimization. Absolutely irrelevant whatsoever in every way, because Henry VII claimed the crown by God's divine judgment. He claimed the crown, in his own words, through conquest. When he became king, he was the king because he simply won the battlefield. Parliament agreed, and they vested the crown forevermore in only Henry VII's line. Mm-hmm. All other claims were rendered illegitimate, you know, illegal, not allowed. They were all only from Henry VII's line onwards, because that's what he stipulated and that's what Parliament agreed. And that's still in place today. You know, all monarchs since Henry VII have been descended directly from him. So that's first and foremost. When we're talking about this so-called barren, it's actually irrelevant. which is a funny way of actually kind of almost saying, why are we going to spend the next 10 minutes talking about it? But it comes up all the time. It is obviously very much a hot topic whenever anyone mentions the word Beauforts. As soon as you hear the word Beauforts anywhere, especially on social media, and trust me, over the years I know, you hear about this barring. So let's quickly look at the actual act of legitimization, first of all. In 1396, John of Gaunt marries Catherine Swynford. He then starts the process of legitimizing his children for the reasons we've already discussed. He does two things. He appeals to the Pope and he appeals to Parliament. This allows him to satisfy the two laws of the day, you know, the church and the common law. Now, we have papal letters recorded in 1396 that show that John of Gaunt sent a messenger to the Pope, and the Pope was happy to confirm the marriage contracted by John of Gaunt and Catherine Swynford. It is the Pope's judgment that their children, past and future, were declared legitimate. So that's first and foremost. A couple of months later, January 1397, Parliament assembles in Westminster. And, you know, it's a very long, rambling act of Parliament. But the bottom line is that the Beauforts are permitted to be raised, elected, and assume all owners in the land as if they were born in lawful matrimony. That's what Parliament said in 1397. So John of Gaunt, before his death, he established, as far as church or common law would allow, the legitimacy of his Beaufort offspring. Nobody could invalidate that. Nobody could dispute that. It is there in 1397, in the Act of Parliament, endorsed by the Pope. Now, 10 years later, there's a new king. It is Henry Bolingbroke, Henry IV, the half-brothers of the Beauforts. And we suddenly get this instant where John Beaufort, the eldest of the Beaufort children, has asked for an exemplification of his legitimacy. Now, there's two possible reasons I can see for this happening. One is that 10 years later, John Beaufort suddenly has children of his own. Because he's been made legitimate, he's been allowed to rise in the nobility, and he is now the Earl of Somerset. You know, he couldn't have done that before he was made legitimate. Now he's legitimate, he's the Earl of Somerset. He's doing very well for himself, and his half-brother is the king. Could it be that he just wanted to double-check that everything was, you know, hunky-dory? Was everything above board? More likely, I would now suggest, is an exemplification means a copy of. People lose patents. They lose documents all the time during the medieval age. That's why we have the exemplification process. You're just asking for another copy of something you've already been granted, land, property, inheritance. So he asks for this exemplification and he gets it. Now, historians and people all over social media now say it was at this moment that Henry IV added a bar to the act of legitimacy. He added three simple words, accepta dignitat regali. And he added this to the document to show that the Beauforts could attain all honours in the land, you know, earldoms, dukedoms, etc. But they could not attain to the royal dignity. They could not become kings. And that's what everyone says. It was added in 1407. The Beauforts were barred. The Tudors were barred. End of story. No one's actually bothered to look into this. I looked into it because I seem to have been the only person who cared about the Beauforts at one point. So I looked into this a bit further. And this is what I found out. I looked at the original Act of Parliament in 1397. This is the Act of Parliament that grants the Beauforts rights to everything. And it is true. There are three words written on this document, except to the royal dignity. But they've been scribbled in between the lines of the existing text to alter the meaning of the text. But they have been scribbled in almost like graffiti in between the lines. I think the official term is an interlineation. Now, we don't know who added these three words. We don't know when these three words were added. And most importantly, we do know this did not go through Parliament again. So 1407, we have the parliamentary records. There is no evidence whatsoever that this was discussed by Parliament. Parliament agreed to it and Parliament passed it. It didn't exist. All we know is somebody wrote three words on the original Act of Parliament. Now, if Parliament did not discuss this, if Parliament did not endorse those changes, or if Parliament did not just create a new Act of Parliament with those changes, it simply is not a legal document. Mm. It amounts to nothing more than historical graffiti.
Mm.
Now, I don't have enough pull, and nobody cares enough about this document to have it actually analysed. My suggestion is that these three words were added at the time. I believe that they were contemporary. I believe they were probably added under the aegis of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Henry Jacquelli.
Mm.
Now, he was Lord Chancellor at this time. So he was in charge of, well, the Chancery. He was in charge of the clerks. He was in charge of the men who were responsible for looking after these documents. And he was also engaged in something of a Cold War with the Beaufort family in 1407. I can suggest during this period in time when the king was ill, the king was fretting over the succession, there was a war going on at court between the Archbishop on one side and the Beauforts and their nephew, Prince Henry, the future Henry V, on the other side. And I can see the Archbishop getting these three words added to, you know, who knows, to use against the Beauforts down the line. Now, what's important to stress here is, again, first of all, if Parliament does not discuss this or endorse this, it's legally nothing. It's nonsense. It's just graffiti. Secondly, nobody's ever mentioned this bar. It's never been mentioned during the day.
Yeah.
1450, so 50 years later, or 40 years later, wherever, my maths isn't my best feature, there is an accusation levelled at the Duke of Suffolk. The Duke of Suffolk was famously beheaded on a small boat like just before the outbreak of the Wars of the Roses. And one of the claims made against him in Parliament was that he was planning to marry his son, John de la Poole, to a 7-year-old heiress named Margaret Beaufort. And his plan, he was accused of, was that he planned to put his blood on the throne of England. Now, how can that be? How can this 7-year-old girl, Margaret Beaufort, how can she be used to put her blood on the throne if everybody knew the Beauforts were barred from the throne? So that's not mentioned. 1483, Richard III does everything he can to rant, rave, wail against Henry Tudor's background. He issues repeated proclamations calling everybody a cheater, everybody an adulterer. Henry Tudor from nothing. He's from a rubbish background. He goes off on one, ranting like a modern-day Ricardian online. And off he goes. And yet the one thing he never mentions is Henry Tudor was barred. He could have literally just gone, you can't take this guy as your king. He's barred from the throne. Look, I've got the document. He never does that. I believe these words were added by the Archbishop in 1407. The document was rolled back up and people forgot about it.
Mm.
Whichever antiquarian in the 17th century or whenever unrolled this document, logged it in his work, and it's just passed down the centuries. When you read this in print, in a book, the Beauforts can be admitted to all honours except the royal dignity. It looks clear as day, and that's why historians keep on repeating it to this day, which then leads other people to repeat it. They must have been barred. When you look at the actual document, it almost comes crystal clear. This was just scribbled in. Yeah. It has no legal basis. Now, I would have loved to have used that picture in my book. I would love to use it on the internet. It would solve a lot of problems. Unfortunately, the National Archives asked for too much money for me to publish that. So,
yeah.
And I seem to be the only person who's actually bothered to look at it because it's such a niche subject. And I have just wasted 10 minutes ranting about that myself. It won't be the last time I discuss it. And I always stress it is almost an irrelevant subject.
Mm-hmm.
Because Henry VII didn't even use that to become king. He used the act of conquering the country to be king.
The thing is, barring the Beauforts from Henry IV, barring the Beauforts from the throne doesn't make sense. They weren't a threat to him. He had, what was it, 4 sons who would come after him. He had no reason to not to think that his sons would be on the throne in perpetuity. So why bar his legitimate half brother when he's got 4 sons who are going to succeed him anyway?
Who could ever have foreseen that in 1407, the House of Lancaster, within 30 years, would end up with just Henry VI. Now, who could ever foresee that? I also think not a lot of work is put into analysing the feud that takes place between Edmund Beaufort, the Duke of Somerset, and Richard, Duke of York, in the late 1440s and the early 1450s. Now, the War of the Roses is not a war between York and Lancaster. It's a war between York and Beaufort. It always was. From the outset, it is those two men fighting to be the number two that leads to the outbreak of war. I mean, it leads in 1455 to the Battle of St. Albans, which is nothing more than an assassination. It's a mob hit by the Yorkists on Edmund Beaufort. York has tried everything he can to get rid of this guy, and he's left to, well, to use mafia terminology, rubbing him out. and, you know, lo and behold, it becomes a dynastic war. No one ever seems to mention, was it almost an unspoken issue between these two men who hated each other over who was next in line for the throne? Because Henry VI didn't have a son until 1453. So you've got all of 1440s, you've got the first couple of years of 1450s. Who the hell is next in line for the throne? Now, regardless of what people think today, we didn't have a line of succession back then. It doesn't exist. It's simply not the case that X had a better claim, Y had a better claim. All they did back then in the medieval times was they had the king and his sons. You know, there was no, oh, well, if this line dies out, the crown should move to this line or that line. Today, it's codified in law. We know exactly who is the 49th person in line to the throne. So I'm also tired of always hearing, oh, well, this person had a better claim or that person had a better claim. There's no such thing. You know, might was the only right, first of all. So I can believe that there was an issue in 1450-ish between Edmund Beaufort and Richard of York, who was going to be next. And that is also adds a lot of tension to their rivalry. Now, another issue during this period is in 1452, Henry VI, possibly, again, historians always keen and careful to use terms like possibly, because I don't know for a fact. I believe Henry VI possibly started to have ideas about his half-brother, Edmund Tudor. He knows he has no son at the moment. He's got Edmund Beaufort on one side. He's got Richard, Duke of York, on the other side fighting. He's also got his half-brother, who he's helped raise, Edmund Tudor. And he's also got his cousin, the young Margaret Beaufort, who is the senior Beaufort family heiress, or certainly in the run-in. He marries his cousin Margaret Beaufort to his half-brother Edmund Tudor. Was Henry VI trying to create another Tudor Beaufort line of succession a lot closer to his crown than any other option? Now, of course, I don't believe that would have played out if he had continued down this line, because I'm not sure people would have bought it that early. Mm-hmm. But was that Henry VI's intention? Now, this is all rendered almost another irrelevant line of inquiry, because Henry VI, the following year, 1453, does have a son. So we never see where this potential dynastic war would have played out until later in the decade, when suddenly York does go against the crown, full stop. So, you know, it's all very interesting, it's all very fascinating, and always be wary of people who talk about whoever had the greatest right online.
Well, I think a lot of discussion, modern discussion about the Wars of the Roses, is based on modern ideas of what people think life was like. And it's usually wrong, because the medieval mindset is completely different. The things they regarded as significant, important, even crucial, are very different from the sort of things that we value and regard as being important. So, yeah, I mean, that's just one of many things in the Wars of the Roses which one could take issue with. And I will do in my book later in the year. I mean, you've implied, I think you might actually have said, that Henry IV got on well with the Beauforts. Was that always the case? Did they always... And what about the young prince? You mentioned Prince Henry. Was he on good terms with the Beauforts or not?
Yeah, so there doesn't seem to be any real evidence of any breach between the Beauforts or you know, the main Lancastrian line. We know that when Henry Bolingbroke invades England in 1399 to, you know, become king, he gets to Bristol. I mean, I'm going to have to really try and remember now how people can, you know, pick up my book, The House of Beaufort, on sale at all good bookshops. Off the top of my head, I believe there was an incident where Henry Bolingbroke, soon to be Henry IV, reaches Bristol, and he is met there by his half-brother, John Beaufort. Now, John Beaufort, to this point, had been, you know, loyal to the crown, as most men were, loyal to the crown of Richard II. And one of Henry IV's men tries to attack John Beaufort. And Henry IV stops him and says, "Leave my brother alone, for he has always been loyal to me." And they hug. And it's quite a nice, touching, you know, incident of showing that John Beaufort, you know, probably like the Stanleys later at Bosworth, playing their cards close to their chest until the crucial moment when they can then reveal who they are loyal to. But John Beaufort clearly was always down for his brother, Henry IV. We have another remarkable insight into a wonderful lady called Joan Beaufort, the only female of the original Beaufort foursome. She looks generously upon a couple who have fallen foul of the law for marrying without permission. And what she does, she uses her power to influence as a great northern magnate, and she also uses her connections at court, since her half-brother happens to be the king. She writes to Henry IV and, you know, she asks after his health. She's very concerned with his maladies, and she asks him to intercede on behalf of this young couple. This is remarkable. The idea that a king of England, a king as ill as Henry IV, a king struggling with factional discord, a king struggling with repeated conspiracies and plots to kill him, could give any care whatsoever about some random couple in the north. But, you know, she lobbies him. And the letter is quite a touching insight into a relationship between a half-brother and a half-sister, suggesting, of course, there is closeness there. And Henry IV is generous to his Beaufort siblings. Again, there's no evidence whatsoever of a breach in relations. Now, when it comes to the prince himself, the future Henry V, this is where it gets more interesting, because Henry V is actually closer in age to his Beaufort uncles than his father was. You know, it's just a matter of, I think he's about 9 years younger, for example, than Thomas Beaufort, the youngest of the Beaufort brood. So he's actually a lot closer to the Beauforts than Henry IV is. And they create almost their own faction at court. The Beauforts and the Prince Henry, they are aligned, and they want to take it to the older, out-of-touch courtiers around the king. And it's quite interesting, because when Henry V becomes king, he brings the Beauforts along with him. You know, they are the most powerful men around the crown. We have Bishop Henry Beaufort, the Bishop of Winchester, who would become a cardinal, one of the most powerful men in the 15th century, the chief financier, really, of the Lancastrian dynasty. You know, very few people ploughed more money into keeping the Lancastrians on the throne than Henry Beaufort. And why wouldn't he? He was, of course, a Lancastrian himself. And then we have Thomas Beaufort, one of the younger Beauforts. So as I said, he's an uncle of Henry V. He is about 9 years older in age, so quite close, you know, more like a brother than an uncle, really. And him and Henry V have a really tight bond. And I think this is forged in youth. At Ludlow in 1402, young Prince Henry is earning his spurs in how to be a warrior. He's fighting against the Welsh, and he would soon fight in the Battle of Shrewsbury with his father against the Percys. He is getting educated, unfortunately for me, against the Welsh. You know, that's who he's that's where he's getting his education. But next to him, during this whole period, also getting his education, is Thomas Beaufort. And Thomas Beaufort has been reared to be the soldier in the Beaufort family. And they stayed together all the way through to the end of Henry V's life. When the wars of Henry V take place across the Channel in France, one of his most trusted lieutenants, one of his most trusted commanders, is Thomas Beaufort. You know, very few men should be afforded, you know, the position of responsibility that Thomas Beaufort had. He was granted right to be the governor of Rouen. He was granted the right to be governor of Paris. Every time Henry V needed someone dependable to stand in for him, he turned to Thomas Beaufort. He was unquestionably one of the last greatest knights of the Middle Ages. And that's because of his tight bond between what had been two young men and had grown into being two great warriors. Unfortunately, Thomas Beaufort does seem to have been written out somewhat of a lot of the history of this period. He does appear in Shakespeare's play as the Duke of Exeter, which many people might know if they know their Shakespeare. But I do interpret my reading of the period as the Beauforts and Lancasters being close. And that would never change. I mean, obviously, it's a major issue with the Wars of the Roses, how close Edmund Beaufort is to Henry VI.
Yeah.
And of course, if you want to take it even further, the Battle of Bosworth was, at heart, Beaufort versus York again. Even though Richard III was, whispered really quietly, of Beaufort descent as well.
Yes. Yes, he was descended from Joan, the youngest.
Yeah.
I think that's actually a case in point. The Beauforts do appear to be everywhere in the 15th century. How did they become so influential? Was it because they were the brothers of the king, or was it marriage?
I think the crucial point is two men and one woman of the first generation were hugely influential in that we have, as already mentioned, Bishop Henry Beaufort. He was one of the most ambitious and wise, cunning even men of the 15th century. You know, his tentacles spread all over Europe. Mm-hmm. At one point, he was really a powerful and clearly competent man. And he is able to not only become the power behind the throne in many respects with his money, he's able to raise up his protégés. He's able to put his nephews and nieces and nephews even at the forefront of power. You know, he's able to use his influence. You know, it's classic nepotism. So we have Henry Beaufort, first of all, positioning the pieces on the board. We have Thomas Beaufort, his brother, who also, you know, by far my favourite Beaufort, who through, you know, his bravery in war and, you know, his pious nature, his loyalty to Lancaster, he's able to establish a really strong foothold at the heart of the House of Lancaster. It's a shame that Thomas would die without children, because who knows how influential his children could have been during the later Wars of the Roses. And then we have Joan Beaufort. Now, Joan Beaufort eventually becomes a northern countess. She marries Ralph Neville up in Yorkshire. She has 14 children with him. And together, they establish an incredible legacy, primarily through intermarriage with all the other great noble families of the land, to the point that by the mid-15th century, half of the bloody nobility in England are descended directly from Joan Beaufort. And that includes men like Richard III, Edward IV, Warwick the Kingmaker. If we want to use that completely not contemporary phrase, the Cousins Wars, for the Wars of the Roses, it's not because it's York and Lancaster, it's because they're all Joan Beaufort's grandchildren. So first and foremost, we've got the three elder Beauforts establishing their chess pieces on the board, if you will. Then we have the second generation. Now, a lot can be written perhaps of how capable the second generation were. I mean, Edmund Beaufort is perhaps the best known example, who was the man who York hated, was the right-hand man of Henry VI, a man often regarded as incompetent, and that's the reason why York essentially went to war with him. Was he competent? Was he incompetent? I mean, it's a debate to be had, but he clearly had been positioned next to the king his entire life and was there for the duration. I mean, he was there. He was so close to the king, and they had to kill him to get him out of the way, which in itself created a whole world of trouble because his children then just wanted vengeance. And his son, Henry Beaufort, another Henry Beaufort, did get his vengeance because he killed Richard of York at the Battle of Wakefield. But then that created another son who wanted vengeance, which was Edward IV. And on it goes until Henry VII came along and wiped the slate clean. So you know, it is that original generation who really did make the best of the hand that dealt them. You know, they were illegitimate in their early 20s. They couldn't get any roles in the church. They couldn't become noble magnates. All doors to their advancement were closed off until their father got them legitimized. But they definitely went ahead and pressed on in life. You know, of the original generation, just to end the point, the eldest, John Beaufort, became Earl of Somerset. You know, he was the one who ultimately would, Margaret Beaufort would be his heiress. You have John Beaufort, Earl of Somerset. We then have Cardinal Henry Beaufort, one of the most powerful men in Europe, and at one point tried to become Pope. Unfortunately for him, they don't do English popes. So his ambitions were curtailed there. We have Thomas Beaufort. He was initially supposed to be just a soldier in the family, but he rose high enough to become the Duke of Exeter. In fact, at the point he was made Duke of Exeter in 1419, because he was doing so good in France, there were only three other dukes in all of England, and all three were the brothers of Henry V. So Thomas Beaufort was the only duke who was not made, who was not brother of the king. And I think that says two things. That says the closeness between the Beauforts and the Lancasters, that he was, that Henry V was willing to make one of his, someone who wasn't his brother, a duke, and also just how competent he must have been. You know, he earned that honour. And it was another recognition. He earned that honour as well because he was one of us. He was a Lancaster at heart. And then the youngest one, Joan Beaufort, who became Countess of Westmoreland, and I consider her to be the mother of the 15th century, based on how many of her descendants became so prominent. She really laid out her plan ahead of her and saw it through. You know, she was redoubtable in every manner of the word. People always talk about Margaret Beaufort, and I think they talk about her rightfully, or at least some people talk about her rightfully, as being a great and a wonderful woman who really thrived in a man's world. But we should look a lot more at Joan Beaufort, first and foremost. What's often forgotten as well at this point is people often consider Henry Tudor to have been the first Beaufort king. You know, very famously, his mother's Margaret Beaufort. Not true in that, as already touched upon, Edward IV and Richard III, and we should never forget another true king, Edward V. Edward IV, Edward V, and Richard III were all Beaufort blooded. You know, their grandmother was Cecily Neville, or their mother even was Cecily Neville, who was the daughter of Joan Beaufort. So they were Beaufort descended. But the first king who was Beaufort descended was actually James of Scotland, James II of Scotland. And that's because his mother was a different Joan Beaufort. So just going back to the Bishop of Winchester, Cardinal Henry Beaufort, he was so ambitious that in 1424, I want to say, or 1425, he married his niece, Joan Beaufort, into the Scottish royal family. And that's a remarkable ambition for a man who only 25 years earlier had been illegitimate with all the doors closed to him. So I think to answer your question in a one sentence line, not the last 10 minutes which I've taken up, how did the Beaufort become so influential? Cardinal Henry Beaufort. Once he got legitimized, he started strategizing how to keep his family center of politics. And it worked until it didn't.
I would just like to point out to our listeners that Nathan wrote this book. Well, it was published 7 years ago. So he wrote it 8-9 years ago. And he still knows so much. He's done so much detail into these responses. It's absolutely fabulous. I just wanted to point out how good your memory must be, Nathan.
I think one thing that I do find difficult, and obviously you both know this yourselves, is when you're writing a book, you really do, you live it. Mm. You live every single person, moment. And then as soon as you've written it, you forget it all.
Yeah.
I mean, I have forgotten 95% at least of what I've written. And it's very frustrating. Sometimes you do flick through the book and you sit there and you're suddenly reading your own book and you're like, oh, this is fantastic. This guy's brilliant. I did not know that this person did this or this happened. And then, oh, hang on, I wrote this. I live this castle siege for 2 weeks, you know. So thank you for that, because, you know, yeah, you do forget.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, yeah. So I think you've told us already that your favourite Beaufort is Thomas, and you make a good case for that. What about your least favourite?
It's quite difficult, because obviously the problem of a biographer is that, for better or for worse, you do get taken with your subjects. Mm. I mean, there's a reason why you're writing books in the first place. And you can call it historian bias, you can call it whatever you want, but the fact is, for most of us, we grow to like, defend, champion the people we write about. And that's just should be expected. If I had to pick a least favourite Beaufort, with that being said, I would probably go for John Beaufort, who's the father of Margaret Beaufort. And the reason for that is he just seems to have been a rash idiot. Basically, he got captured in battle at the age of about 21. And he spent the next 20 years in French prison as a prisoner of the French awaiting ransom. And the ransom was never really paid. And I think there's reasons for it. But going back to our previous question, I just can't remember the political circumstances. But wherever they were, he remained in French hands for 20 years. I think the English had a Duke of Orleans or something. They did, yeah, they didn't, and they didn't want to exchange it.
They did, yeah.
But eventually, in his mid-40s, he gets ransomed. This is about 1443, 1444. He comes out, and he is the senior head of the family. He is the Duke of Somerset. He is the man. But in the 20 years he's been away, his younger brother, Edmund Beaufort, has been the champion of the family. He's been the one running the show, as well as obviously a lot of other wider magnates. But John Beaufort comes out of prison. It's my turn to go back and fight the French. Straight away, he wants to go back across the Channel. Now, his uncle, Cardinal Henry Beaufort, goes, okay. And this is also a big problem with the Beaufort family, is that other members of the nobility didn't have the money or weren't given the money to fight, including the Duke of York.
Mm.
The Beauforts had their uncle's cash, and he just simply funded their escapades. Mm. John Beaufort goes straight back over to France and gets bartered again. And then he gets another war chest. He gets bartered again. I view him as coming out of prison like a bat out of hell. He's so rash, he's so desperate to go and make up for lost time that he doesn't stop for a moment and think, do I even know what I'm doing? So he loses against the French a few times. He is earning the enmity of the jealous Duke of York, who's just watching the Beauforts splurge this English money to no avail. He comes back and he dies in uncertain circumstances. Now, it's often said this was suicide. It may very well have been. But we are told that he dies in Corfe Castle, the Beaufort seat, in uncertain circumstances suddenly. The one source that says this may have been by his own hand is the Crowland Chronicler. Now, our friend at Crowland is a very good insight into all things 15th century, but it does need to be stressed that the Abbey of Crowland and John Beaufort were engaged in a dispute at the time of his death. He owned Deepin Manor, and he wanted to build a road across the Fenland there, and he didn't want the Abbey to be allowed to use it. And the Abbey were furious about this, and it was just a bit of a local neighbourly issue. But I can see a scenario where just a bit of spiteful gossiping put in by the Chronicler. It is said that he died by his own hand, but who knows, or how, whatever the quote goes. And that's obviously come down as a fact, because we can only use the evidence we have to it. So I think it's unproven that he died by suicide, but, and obviously it's quite a, for the medieval time, that's quite a big charge. the point is he died. I mean, how he died before his time. Mm. He at this point, I forgot to say that he had been basically banished from court. He'd come home. He was denigrated. He was, you know, he failed. He was an idiot. And he disappeared. I've made myself look bad now, because it's almost made it sound like this guy has been banished from court in shame. You know, literally hounded to his grave either way. And he's my least favourite, but hopefully I'll be able to stress that basically I don't really have least favourite, but I think it would be him. Just he just didn't get up too much, and it's a shame that he wasted 20 years of his time in a French prison. He did leave behind a one-year-old daughter, Margaret Beaufort, and his death left her being the senior Beaufort heir in the male line. And she would obviously transmit that legacy with aplomb to her only child, Henry Tudor.
It does make you wonder what his life might have been like if he hadn't spent 20 years in imprisonment.
Yeah, he could have ended up being, you know, trained better in the art of politics and the art of war. You know, he's simply been removed from the scene at 21 and has come back at 44, whatever he was, but without the knowledge that he would have gained during them years. And in the meantime, his younger brother, Edmund Beaufort, has taken up the family mantle. Now, Edmund Beaufort himself might have felt a bit put out when his brother came back. Like, oh, God, I've now got to defer to you, even though I've been the one fighting the French for the last 15 years. You know, Edmund Beaufort gets a bad rap. You know, he clearly did have these losses in 1449, 1450 in France, essentially caused the English position in France to collapse. You know, Edmund Beaufort was the man in charge of the loss of Cannes and the loss of Rouen. Mm. And that really, really, you know, upset the Duke of York to see these cities lost. I think the evidence suggests Edmund Beaufort didn't really have, there wasn't really much he could have done about it. The French simply were in the ascendancy too much at this time. He had to surrender those towns, but obviously this created a lot of heat on his position in England. But it's often overlooked just how good or how successful Edmund Beaufort was in the 1430s in France and the early 1440s. I mean, in 1436, at the Siege of Calais, Edmund Beaufort was the hero of England. History isn't black and white. History isn't goodies and baddies and people who have done good and people who have done bad. It's a lot more complex than that. Everything can be, I mean, ultimately it all comes down to narrative. Another word for narrative might be propaganda. Mm. You know, Richard of York was great at narrative, i.e. propaganda, and he was fantastic at, you know, building himself up as being a wonderful, great reformer and the man England needs. And I'd argue possibly England did need Richard of York. You know, Richard III might have been a great king. Those things can be true, whilst they also have negatives against them. And Richard of York, you know, York's propaganda is a fantastic thing throughout the Wars of the Roses, starting with Richard of York and his reformist programme that painted Edmund Beaufort into being an incompetent person who led England into its darkest period. And of course, that just rolled on throughout the period. I mean, Edmund Beaufort was blamed for his own death after the Battle of St. Albans in the parliamentary records, because the Yorkists controlled it, and there was no one really to speak up for him at that point. And these things stick, you know, mud sticks, as we know with Henry Tudor and Richard of York. Propaganda did not begin with the Tudors. I think that's a good point to get in there.
You were looking for where to get that in, weren't you?
Yes.
So what attracted you to the story of the Beauforts?
Henry Tudor, first of all. So once I got proper hooked into the life and the times and the story of Henry Tudor, two things jumped out. One, no one ever seemed to care much about him, and no one ever seemed to write about him. When I got into this in 2009, the most recent biography had been Sean Cunningham's Academic Legend of a Book, which came out in 1997. And then before that, another academic study, S.B. Grimes, in 1972. That was it, you know. And if you're wanting to go straight to reading academic books, that's very tough to do. No one goes straight to reading academic, historical, examinations of King's financial policies. You need what we're doing. You need narrative history to read. And they simply didn't exist with Henry VII. First of all, much less tracking down his Welsh line, which obviously anyone who's listening to this podcast this long will understand why I was keen to go down the Welsh line. But also the Beaufort line. One or two books out there by Margaret Beaufort at the time. I think Elizabeth Norton, around that time, published a book on Margaret Beaufort. And then you're going back to another academic study in 1992 by one of my all-time heroes, Michael K. Jones, and Malcolm Underwood. So how do I learn more about the Beauforts? I start to read a bit through of these books, put together some notes. I am just starting blogging around this time, and I'm trying to put what I'm learning into mini blogs. You both know what it's like. Once you chase down a footnote, you keep on chasing and chasing, and ultimately, there's no real end. there is no, you know, none of us can complete this history game. We're never going to know.
No.
It's not possible. At some point, you just have to, I'm going to stop writing the book here, and, you know, be damned with it. I mean, look at my Henry VII and the Tudor Pretenders book. I published it. I could have kept on going for 20 years. I published it, and suddenly the case has been solved after I've published the book. So I was doing research because I was interested in them, and I started to build up a bit more, you know, notes. And then comes the key thing here, is that when you're writing a book or you want to publish a book, you need to know what the gap in the market is. I mean, there's no point in publishing the same book 100 times over. Although that doesn't stop people with the six wives of Henry VIII. But there's no point in publishing the same book. And I, you know, the Beaufort book was the book I wrote that I wanted to read. And it hadn't been done. So I wrote it. You know, that is essentially it. I wanted to learn more about Henry VII's family. No one had written the book, so I wrote it. And I did the same with the Pretenders book. People have written books on Perkin Warbeck. They've written books on Lambert Simnel. No one's put Henry VII in the context of what the hell he was going through tracking down these pretenders. Who cares whether they were princes or not? That's almost an irrelevant side topic in this period. It's what was happening in England during these decades. How did people, whether they were princes or pretenders, claiming to be the rightful king of England, how did that affect what Henry was doing on the ground in England? How did that affect people around him? You know, again, a book that hadn't been written.
I remember saying to you, asking you, we were at York Manor when Mike Jones and Matthew Lewis were giving a presentation of Richard III, and I said to you, why don't you write a biography of Henry VII? And you said, well, I sort of am, because I'm doing Henry VII and the Tudor Pretenders. And it was like, yeah, because that's just a perfect, nobody has looked at it through that angle. And it's just finding a perspective that's new and vibrant and interesting and will draw people in. And I think that's what worked with the Tudor Pretenders one, that it was a different perspective.
Yeah. So I mean, people do ask me, when am I going to write a biography about Henry VII? And I do shy away from it because A, it's a big subject. B, it has kind of been done to an extent now since we've discussed it. People have written about it, and I'm not sure what I can bring to it that's different. And thirdly, with the publication of my next book, I have effectively done it. I've ended up with this kind of unofficial trilogy of books that examine both sides of Henry's family tree and his reign. If I write a book about Henry VII, a lot of it's just going to be almost copy and pasted. And but which, you know, never say never, but at the moment, no, I'm just going to try and sell three books as one.
So you've got a new book coming out soon called Son of Prophecy. Who is that about?
So the subtitle is The Rise of Henry Tudor.
Oh, that's a clue then.
Well, I mean, again, another pull in the curtain back to let people into our behind-the-scenes world. Tudor sells well. The word Tudor in a book title for search engine optimization has to be included. People asked me about why do I have Henry VII and the Tudor pretenders in the title of my last book. They weren't Tudor pretenders. They were Yorkist, you evil Tudor propagandist. And I say, well, there's two reasons there. One, Tudor is an era, so these were pretenders during the Tudor period. Whether you like it or not, Tudor has been established name for that period for hundreds of years. And secondly, I need Tudor in there so that it comes up on Amazon search. Sorry if people don't like that, but that is just how the book publishing industry works. So The Son of Prophecy, The Rise of Henry Tudor. The second half of the book is Henry Tudor's story. It's his birth, 14 years in exile. It's his Bosworth preparations. You know, the battle is perhaps a page or two at best because, you know, the battle was fought. Richard was killed. That's it. You know, I'm not going to sit there poring over the archaeology of the battlefield when there's much better books out there that can do it. But what I am telling you is how Henry's getting funding in Brittany, how he's writing letters, how he's writing, how he's escaping plots. You know, no one's done that yet. So I'm giving you the insight in literally the rise of Henry Tudor, how he gets to Bosworth. But that's the second half of the book. The first half of the book is 300 years of his family background in Wales. It's where did they even come from? And that was interesting for me because I had to write all about King John. I had to write about Edward I's conquest of Wales, Magna Carta. I don't know much about that subject other than the basics. I'm having to explore. I don't like King John. He's an asshole. you know, but you're having to explore all of this. And then the 14th century, again, I know about the Beauforts, but it's still a bit of a blank century for me. I don't know much about the Cressy campaign and the Black Death. You know, that's not my specialty, but I had to cover it to put my characters in their context of their time. We have Owen Tudor. You know, how did a Welshman, a Welsh squire, attract, marry, and father children with a queen, you know, Welsh charm.
It's not a bad story, is it?
No, yeah. But it's an incredible, incredible epic. And I think I've done what I did with the Beaufort book. I mean, the Beaufort book by far seems to be my most well-received and highest-selling book. And I think a lot of people, they like how tight the story was, how fast the narrative was. And the reason for that, because I simply had to cut 50,000 words out. And I was devastated at the time, but it made the book so fast-paced. You know, I've almost mastered it now, I think. I'm never going to master it, but I'm a lot better now than where I was writing the Beaufort book in knowing what story is going to hit, what the golden thread is from the start to the end. Like people always ask, I got this from Chris Skidmore. I went to a talk that Chris Skidmore did long before I even dreamed of writing books. You were starting your book, your first line in your book and your last line. There's a reason why you're telling the story. And he was discussing this with his Bosworth book in particular. You know, never move off that golden thread. Doesn't matter what else is happening. People are going to say, you didn't include this or that. You don't know what you're talking about. Irrelevant. I'll just give you a perfect example from the Beaufort book. I write in reasonable length in that book about the Battle of Towton, the Second Battle of St. Albans, the Battle of Hedgeley Moor, the Battle of Hexham. And I scarcely mention in a line what happened at the Battle of Mortimer's Cross, for example, because the Beauforts were at some of those battles and they weren't at others. I'm going to write what my guys were up to in this battle. I'm going to write what they're doing, what they're thinking, what they're feeling. Mortimer's Cross, oh, well, the battle was fought this day. Now, what this meant for the Beauforts was never get off that golden line. And what I like about that is across my books, so like my Beaufort book, I didn't write about Mortimer's Cross. My Son of Prophecy book, Jasper Tudor was there. I'm all over the Mortimer's Cross campaign. And it all kind of fits together a lot. Obviously, if you're writing a Wars of the Roses book, you can't do that. That is your golden thread. But I think it's a valuable lesson to let people know. And it's worked well for me.
I've advised a number of writers about that, actually. It's, the way I do it, I remember it, is my A-level teacher used to tell me, answer the question. Know what your question is at the beginning and answer that question. And if you start going offline, are you answering the question or have you gone off on a tangent? So that's what brings me back. Same thing, the golden line, answer the question. Just stick to the question you've set yourself and answer that. And it helps you stay focused and make sure you don't include irrelevancies. It's a learning curve, though, isn't it? I mean, like you, my first book came out the same year as the Beauforts did. So it's just a learning curve of what you...
Yeah.
And it's a steep learning curve when you write your first book because you don't get your hand held by your editor. That was a bit of a surprise for me. You know, they just leave you to it and then wait until you send in the manuscript. So do you have a new project in the works or are you taking a break?
I'm retired at the moment. So no, I don't have a new project in the works. It's the first time in 10 years I'm not writing at all, which may be why you might be seeing a bit more blogging and substacking from me at the moment, because it's quite nice because all of my other previous books, I've got the contract in just about as I submit. So you're just straight back into it. But, you know, I haven't really read a book for enjoyment in 10 years. So I'm reading, I'm just relaxing. Half of me thinks I'm just wasting time every day that I'm not writing, because when you've done it for 10 years, every single day, every single moment, there's not really an obvious subject to write about. I'm never going to be an author who's just going to write books just to write them. All three of those books I've written, they've been passion projects. You know, I have something I want to tell you all about. I have something I want to knock on your door until everyone agrees with me kind of projects. And now I don't. I do have a long list of book title ideas. You know, so there's definitely ideas there, but no, at the moment I'm retired, which is good actually, because you know I'm able to spend more time actually promoting talks and getting back into all of that. You know, just giving myself a bit more free time to actually enjoy the promotion of this book and so on. But never say never. I mean, we all know it's an addiction. So
yeah. Well, it has been absolutely wonderful talking to you, Nathan. I think our listeners are actually going to enjoy the insight into the writing process because we don't always cover that. It's always nice to have a chat with other historians and who know your pain. Well, yeah, it's been absolutely fabulous chatting with you today, Nathan. Thanks so much for joining us and telling us about The House of Beaufort. I do recommend it. It is an absolutely fabulous book. And I am hoping that The Son of Prophecy, which will be out in, is it July?
15th of July.
Which is out in July, the month after my next book, which is Heroines of the Tudor World. Right, that's all my advertising for today, I think. Thank you so much for joining us, Nathan. I mean, it has been amazing chatting with you. I think we could probably go on for a few more hours.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, very good to meet you, Nathan.
Thank you, Nathan. Do join us next time when we will be joined by Griff Hoster to talk about the Norman Conquest and William the Conqueror. I've been Sharon Bennett Connolly.
And I'm Derek Burks. Thanks for listening. And do subscribe to avoid missing a podcast. If you enjoyed it, perhaps give it a like. We'd love to have a rating or a review from you. Join us next time.